digging in the dirt. Digging in the dirt.
This is Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher, where Kevin and his guests dig a little deeper into today's issues surrounding the environment, farming, gardening, and food.
My guest today on Digging in the Dirt is Jennifer Jewell. Jennifer is a gardener, garden writer, and gardening educator and advocate. Since 2016, she has written and hosted the national award-winning weekly public radio program and podcast, Cultivating Place. She is particularly interested in the intersections between gardens, the native plant environments around them, and the human culture. Jennifer has been writing about gardening professionally since 1998. It's my distinct pleasure to have Jennifer here on Digging in the Dirt today to talk about her book, The Earth in Her Hands, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, firstly, I got to tell you, thank you so much for getting me a hard copy of your book so quickly. I was reading an electronic version, but I'm old-fashioned and I love holding a book in my hands, and your book is a pleasure to hold and read.
That's great.
Yep. It's, you know, it's beautifully rendered and the pictures are gorgeous, but most of all, the stories of these 75 women are pretty compelling, and it's quite nice to read about these dynamic women. Let me ask you, why did you choose to title the book in part, Women Working in the World of Plants?
Well, I really wanted to focus on not just the joy of gardening or the beauty of gardening and working with plants, but on the fact that it is a life's work and a career work for so many women. And we don't often get that view of women working with plants and in horticulture, that they are leaders in a professional sense as well as an enjoyment sense.
You know, I like the way you start each chapter with a brief profile that tells us what plant or landscape is the favorite of the person you're writing about. What do you think about those choices? What does it tell us about these women?
Well, I really loved that also. And I couldn't choose between asking them about a plant versus a landscape that resonated with them. And so I think in part you learn something, you have an insight into them as people based on if they choose that sort of macro version of a single plant or single plant story or an entire ecosystem that really resonates with them. And it's not necessarily the favorite so much as one that resonates with them right now, because I think, you know, it's like all of us as gardeners or or parents even, you know, you can't really pick a favorite child or a favorite plant, but one that was really speaking to them. And there were just some fantastic stories encapsulated in these answers. You know, somebody talked about like the cabbage growing out of the compost or the strength and vigor of a garlic. And you just get a real sense for their personalities. And more than one person actually discussed the dandelion and its tenacity and its ubiquity and its medicinal nature and its real just invincibility against humans as a wonderful illustration of fortitude and creativity.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But my favorite plant is a tomato.
There's a lot to be said about that. That's an insight into you, right?
Yeah, well, everybody knows that I love growing tomatoes. I was out in the garden this morning picking them and drying them, all the cherry tomatoes this morning.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite?
It's so hard to say, but I would have to go with some days it's the oak, some days it's the willow. A lot of days it's some form of salvia or geranium. So there you go.
Okay. You also write about each person's plant journey. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, you know, I think that's the sort of genesis story for each of these women in terms of, you know, where they were born and raised. It's a question I ask on my program all the time, and you do as well. The idea of, you know, you're born and raised, and at some point in your life, you come to recognize that plants are part of you. And once you become conscious of that, you can frequently look further back than that moment and see where it really started, even though you didn't notice it at the time. So like seeds or stories handed down from grandparents or neighbors, or, you know, it generally doesn't come out of nowhere. And there's something I like about that journey story of first recognizing and then kind of mapping how plants, people are grown, because it gives such a nice map for people who maybe haven't looked at it more deeply in their lives, and or who haven't yet had that, you know, born again moment with plants of saying, oh my gosh, if I didn't have them, where would I be? And I think, you know, COVID-19 has clearly been this moment for a lot of people, in that all of a sudden their home and their relationship with the green lives around them, whether that's on a little balcony or a windowsill, or you have the luxury of a small backyard or a big one, all of a sudden this space is very clearly very valuable in our lives. And that story just, I think having readers read someone else's story allows them to see or envision their own journey story with more power and empowerment.
Well, you have a lot of great stories in this book, The Earth in Her Hands. Before we get to some of these ladies, I want to start off by asking about something you mentioned in your book that I find curious. I want to get you to explain, what do you mean by you wanted to, one of your missions is to decolonize your garden?
Well, you know, it became clear to me pretty quickly in starting my garden radio program, which the first iteration started as a more regionally based program in interior Northern California, a region we call the North State. And I started that program in early 2008, and it ran until it became Cultivating Place and became an hour long and more globally focused. But it became apparent to me the disconnect, and it had been clear to me before this when I was writing for glossy magazines as my primary form of, you know, like written expression about gardening, and that there somewhere along the way, 1950s, 1960s, 1940s, I'm not sure when, there became this codified myth that somehow gardening was the purview of middle class and or affluent, primarily white people. On big pieces of land or in the suburbs, and that, you know, that's what you saw in magazines and in advertising. And I think the rise of both glossy magazines and marketing as a tool in our world really helped to create, cement, and perpetuate this myth in a really harmful way that doesn't bear up under any scrutiny when you look across time and space as to who gardeners are and what it means to them. It is not a lifestyle destination. It is not something you can pick up at a big box store this weekend. It is this relationship, and every culture across time and space has this relationship in their own unique way. It became more and more urgent for me in the radio program to talk about this. And so when it came to the book, this was an important element for me, was to make sure that I represented as many different cultural legacies and histories and current modalities as I possibly could.
I think you did it. And one of them is Leah Penniman, which we both had on our shows. She's quite something else with the farming while black. And she addresses what you're talking about quite extensively, because she feels they're at a disadvantage, and she wants the young black women and men to understand they can do this. You know, it's not, and they had a lot to do with it early on in the history of this United States.
Yeah, she is a powerful, powerful voice, especially on behalf of black legacy and history in agriculture and horticulture, and just reclaiming that narrative and expanding it. And I think that's what a lot of the women in the book are doing from wherever they sit. So whether that's, you know, Rowan White and Robin Wall Kimmerer and Elizabeth Hoover and Tiffany Freeman speaking on behalf of their indigenous experiences, or Vandana Shiva in India and Hemlata Pradhan, who is a beautiful botanical illustrator in India, doing something similar with her work. you know, and there are just all these great threads that when you put them together, it's just so much richer of a tapestry to understand what that word gardener or the word garden actually means to us.
Yeah. I love Penniman's story about her great-great-grandmother, I think, who knew the slavers were in the area and the women were weaving seeds into their hair because they didn't know where they may end up if they got stolen and taken away. And mm-hmm. I thought that was such an important story about how the woman thinks like that to be able to be survive and plant and nurture.
Yeah. And, you know, I think one of the great hardships of writing this book was having to narrow down the women's voices to 75 because there could be so many more. And there is a wonderful Black plants woman named Wambui Ippolito, who is online as Wambui or Wamboy, I think is how you say that more correctly, loves plants. And she did a fantastic presentation recently for the Garden Conservancy. She does them regularly, but on the threads of different waves of immigration into the United States and the different plants and seeds and horticultural traditions and knowledge they bring in with each wave. And, you know, that idea of women bringing seeds woven into their hair as enslaved peoples is kind of mirrored in each wave of immigration, of cuttings, you know, sewn into hems of clothing and just tucked anywhere, because you want to take your plant companions with you and you want to make sure you have food when you get wherever you're going. You know, it's this, mm-hmm. you know, and like right now we're in big fire season in California, and you think, if I have to evacuate, what do I take with me? And seeds and plants are among those things we consider to be important and like family.
You know, we're reading these stories of the African-American women, and they're carrying on that tradition of somebody I didn't know about till about a year ago when I interviewed John Edge with his a book called Potlicker Papers. He talked about Fannie Mae Hamer,
right.
who she is unbelievably astounding. And I mean, ended up speaking in front of the Senate in her life. I mean, and coming from a slave of 25 kids, you know, from her slave master, it was just an incredible story that nobody knows about.
Yeah. You know, and I think this is one of those like incredible upsides of this very odd time we find ourselves in the midst of this social reckoning, which is, you know, long past due, and this COVID-19 kind of renaissance of gardening is, I think we are finally getting some expansion in names we know and people who are put out in front of us. And I think more people have heard the name Fannie Lou Hamer in the last 6 months than they have ever heard in their lives. Mm-hmm. And you know, Edna Lewis. And I mean, there are so many names that are coming up that we are just part of the history we weren't told. And I think it's really enriching for all of us.
So I know you said that the people that you spoke to don't pick favorites in plants. Do you pick favorites in women?
No. Oh, my gosh. It's so hard. But, you know, some certainly stand out in the interview process or the relationship I developed with them through the course of reading about their work or interviewing them and then having other connections. But, you know, I think without exception, every woman in this book is a cultivator of community and collaboration. And that was one of their real strengths across the cohort, that leading on a vertical or lateral plane versus an up-down plane was really important to them, both through experience and on principle as they moved into their work lives, that they relied on their, you know, their village, to use that age-old saying, and support networks to see that they could get their work done. And that warmth and connectivity really came out in their willingness to share information and time with me. And some of these women are, you know, so crazy busy, especially, you know, tending land or crops or seeds. And yeah, their generosity and collaborative nature has really shown through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the wisdom just oozes out of this book. I mean, is there a common thread of ideas or philosophy that runs through the work that you discovered?
One of them would be that, the idea that you must tend the collective and lean into the collective to help you when you need it. And I think, you know, they really both embody and advocate for the lessons of plants, the generosity of plants, the abundance of plants, the not just beauty and usefulness, but also the interdependence that plants are showing us all the time. And, you know, so whether they were flower farmers or they were writers or they were, you know, medicine workers, all of these women made it a point to embody and reflect the wisdom of plants.
I have to say, what I like about the book is that you're highlighting things in life through these women that get short shrift in our modern society. I mean, gentleness, nurturing connection to nature, slowing down your existence to take time to smell the flowers, so to speak. Mm-hmm. It's something we're celebrating, and I'm really happy that this comes out in the book over and over and over again.
You know, it really does, and it is the opposite side of the coin that these women also have to have cultivated that sense of nurturing and choosing where they wanted to be in life and what they wanted to do with their lives with such fierce tenacity. It's a very chosen and worked at intentionality and focus for each one of them. And they are, they are fierce supporters and defenders of the principles of caring for the earth, caring for one another, and making better choices in a world that's often kind of tempting us and coercing us into being complicit in ways of life we don't necessarily really believe in if we think about it for long. And it's not to say that they don't want, they want women and all people to be successful. They want them to make a living. They want them to have good quality of life, but not at the expense of one another or the earth, that they really believe you can have a very good life and make a good enough living doing things that are principled in these ways. Yeah.
You're listening to Digging in the Dirt, and my guest today is Jennifer Jewell, who wrote the book, The Earth in Her Hands, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants. So let's talk about some of these women. I have to tell you that I would be remiss. My wife is a huge fan of Florette and Erin Benzekin. She told me, you got to interview her, and I tried, but Erin turned me down. I can't have them all. So, but she's so amazing. I mean, our house is flooded with flowers this year because my wife read the book that she put out. And it's wonderful. You know, it's like we always grew flowers, but we never cut them and brought them in as much as we do now. And it's really nice to see all this color all over the place.
Yeah. You know, Erin is just, she is an empire builder of the best kind. And when she early in her life or her work life decided to move towards growing flowers as what she was being called to do based on, you know, an epiphany moment of sharing sweet peas that had been seed from her grandmother in her business, she took this epiphany of hers and she built it into a sustainable small business that was both organic and financially, like, so sustainable on the land, but also sustainable as a small business. And then she recognized how hungry other, specifically women to start with, I think, but you know, it works for most people, were for a flexible, meaningful work with the things they loved, like growing flowers. And this came at the sort of right simultaneous to this very real wake up in our country that the imported cut flower business was really toxic, both to the financial life of our country and the planet life of our world, that it had so much embodied carbon in it. And so Erin then, you know, modeled what she was doing for a few others, and then more, and then more, and then more. And she has really kicked off this organic flower farming, local business revolution in our country that has empowered households across the country to take their lives into their own hands and grow beauty and have a business that works with their families. Like, it's this genius, if simple, concept that she made happen. And that use of, you know, an industry that you sometimes can dismiss as like, oh, I mean, how important can that be? But it's a huge industry. And she was a leader in it that just cannot be ignored in terms of its power, both as a business and as a financial driver in our world.
Mm-hmm. She's really blown up.
Uh-huh. And, you know, and you look at Deborah Prinzing with the Slow Flowers movement and, you know, Amy Stewart, who wrote the book Flower Confidential, that really helped to kick off this recognition in our world that this industry that we all buy into, you know, at some point or other in the course of a year, can make a real impact in our world, environmentally and financially and socially. And it really has.
Mm-hmm. I love the quotes that you pulled out of your subjects. They could almost be used like daily affirmations.
You know? Right, they can, yeah.
It's crazy, you know, but yeah, really, you go, yeah, I believe that.
Like, right, exactly.
Like Christian Wickert, she says, if I were a landscape, I'd be a desert, able to withstand hard times, then be amazingly beautiful and powerful when the going is good.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. They would make a good little calendar.
Yeah, actually. Something like that. It's just like you want to see them over and over, read them over. How about Margaret Roach? She said, "For me, my garden is my life partner." I believe that. We are one organism, garden and gardener. It is my spiritual home and heartbeat.
Yeah.
Another good one. Mm. Let's see. One more here. Let's see. About Jane Scotter. She said, I mean, I'm generally attracted to biodynamic farmers. They're such sweet people. She said, talking about plants and gardening, these are the interesting things in life, the cultivated pursuits.
Yeah. And she has such a great story on her biodynamic farm in England called Fern Vero. And just, it's fabulous to see what she has done there and in a whole nother kind of angle into like making a life and a living out of what you love to do and really, you know, serving high-end restaurants in London, as well as serving people with a CSA at a time when they really need it in the urban setting, having created this biodynamic farm out in the country after having given up a very successful business in the city. Like, and a lot of these women had that where they had started down one career path and they recognized somewhere along the way, whether it was, you know, having kids, whether someone in their family died, they had this moment where they said, I want to be doing so much more and have it be so much more meaningful to the world than what I'm doing right now. Mm-hmm. And that was interesting to me.
Sure. You know, one of my local acquaintances, a seed-saving acquaintance, she's pretty well known, Steph Gaylor of Invincible Summer Farms, had a mural on the side of her barn that said, they tried to bury us, but didn't know we were seeds. And I always liked that one. And I was reminded of it when I read Rowan White, who's one of your women, the Mohawk woman. And she said, seeds are intimately connected and intertwined with story and lineage, place and people. They illuminate this beautiful co-evolutionary dance that humans and plants have been engaged in for millennia.
Yeah.
Like I said, a lot of wisdom in your book. What about Rowan? Can you tell me anything about her?
Rowan White is definitely one of the leading voices in reclaiming the cultural connection and the cultural reappropriating cultural narrative to plants and seed lineages in their original or furthest back cultural context. So when I say that, that sounds sort of odd and like a lot of strange words, but she is a firm believer in what she calls rematriating seed that came from one tradition back into that tradition so that it can be kept alive and credited to the culture who cultivated it. So, you know, our heirloom corns, instead of, you know, buying them with kind of a flavor or taste or growing season description through a big catalog, understanding that corn was crossed and crossed back and kept alive by Native American cultures, wherever they might be, whether they came from the Northeast or they came from the, you know, California cultures or wherever they might have come from, retracing and reassociating those cultural narratives with the plants and seed that we value right now. And making sure that seed is in the hands of the living cultures who can grow it and keep it going in perpetuity. Because, you know, one of the things we are seeing now with climate change and habitat loss and a lot of inappropriate cultural appropriation this last, you know, 150, if not 400 years, we have often disconnected these plants with the people stories that brought them to us now. And, you know, for instance, the USDA seed bank or germplasm unit in Fort Collins, Colorado has a lot of seed that was collected historically and that may have been lost in the communities from where that seed was originally taken, from Native American cultures across the country. And to get that seed back into the hands of those living cultures and being grown out and evolving with the people it creates a strength and a sovereignty that empowers all of us to make sure that our seed and our food sources have integrity and they have strength and resilience as we move forward in a very uncertain world.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Steph would get along with Rowan. That's what Steph does. She does pumpkins and the Shinnecock currant tomato from the Shinnecock Indians, things like that. You know, so it's, yep. I love that movement. I think it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And it's really powerful work. And she is, I think, still on the board of the Seed Savers Exchange, but more importantly, one of the leading voices in the Indigenous Seed Keepers Network. And in most Indigenous cultures here in, you know, North America, the seed keeping was very specifically a task taken on and made sacred within women groups. It was a matriarchal task and responsibility. And so that's why she calls a lot of, you know, she uses the word to rematriate these seeds back into the communities that they come from historically. And she is a strong and visionary voice in our world right now.
Great. I have to check her out a little bit more. Would I be wrong in saying that, you know, over the last 100 years or so, traditionally, it's a sort of farming is considered like this male activity, and the gardening is sort of this feminine activity. I mean, a woman was instrumental in, you know, the growing of things as the husband was ripping out stumps and making, you know, planting corn and whatever. But she was, you know, doing all the other things too, making soap and whatever. But I think gardening, to me, feels very feminine. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, I think we have to step out a few paces and look at our cultural context, because I don't think you're wrong. I think that in especially the United States in this day and age, the idea of a gardener, I think you see a woman first. Like you hear the word farmer and you see a man first. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever those gender like ideals or, you know, fixed points are at this point is up for anyone. And it's a spectrum. But you go to England and gardening was very much a masculine tradition. And, you know, you still go today to one of the RHS flower shows, and it's the men who are competitive as much as the women with their, you know, chrysanthemums and camellias and whatever it might be. So I think that's a cultural overlay that we should make sure to be aware of. But there is something feminine in terms of feminine being a universal characteristic that we all hold to some extent or another. And farming does seem more masculine in its just general energetic idea. But as we know, both genders and all in between were part and parcel of what we know today. And I think that's an important thing to step back and recall, because the minute we allow for that inclusiveness, we make anybody feel comfortable doing any of these activities that we know you, Kevin, and me, Jennifer, in different places and different ages and different genders, really find to be an important part of our identity. And so I think, you know, if you asked us specifically, we would say we want everybody to feel that. And sometimes those myths, like those perpetuated by glossy magazines and marketing, they begin to exclude who can see themselves there. And we know that's not to the benefit of any of us.
Yeah. Gardening is a benefit to all of us.
Heck yeah. Yeah.
We're talking to Jennifer Jewell in her book, The Earth in Her Hands, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants. Jennifer, this has been really great having you. I have about 25,000 more questions for you, but I'm not going to get there. You know, her book is really great to get in your hands. I mean, you can read through, you know, a couple hours, or you could read one story at a time. It's that kind of book, you know, and it's really quite beautiful. It's really well done. You should be proud of it.
Thank you. I really am. And if I had one great hope, it is that 75,000 young humans read it and see somewhere, like check it out from a library, and or they get given it as a high school graduation gift, and they see in one of these stories the many paths that you can take to really embracing this thing that we love and that makes the world a better place, because there's just so many ways to make it part of your life.
Jennifer Jewell, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Digging in the dirt. Digging in the dirt.
You've been listening to Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher.